Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're getting word of a possible breakthrough this morning toward Arab-Israeli peace. Saudi Arabia has agreed to the idea of regional peace talks, including it and Israel and other countries. The announcement came in a news conference in the Saudi capital today as part of Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates' Mideast tour. They were there to talk to Saudi leaders. They're on to Israel now to talk to Israeli and Palestinian leaders. So could this be the start of a regional Arab-Israeli breakthrough, as the Bush administration hopes? It does come, remember, shortly after Israel released hundreds of Palestinian prisoners who then turned around and signed pledges not to wage war on Israel anymore. But also, of course, it comes in the midst of deep divisions among Palestinians, with Hamas and Fatah factions having broken up their unity government and fighting with each other in the streets of Gaza. So we will take a close look at the evolving situation with David Makovsky. He's director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has been executive editor of the Jerusalem Post and chief diplomatic correspondent for the Post and the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He also teaches at the Johns Hopkins School of International Studies. Good morning, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you, Brian.
So let me read from an AP story circulating this morning. It says, building on warming ties between Israel and moderate Arab countries, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's office says that Israel hopes many Arab countries will attend this international meeting, including Saudi Arabia. That's a quote. And it says the statement came in reaction to an announcement today by Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud al-Faisal that his country had no objection to attending such a gathering. Al-Faisal spoke at a news conference with Rice and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in Jeddah. So how meaningful is that Saudi announcement?
The way I read the announcement, it's a conditional yes. It says that if the conference is going to be dealing with what Prince Saud, the foreign minister, says are the core issues, which is kind of the code word for what we know as final status issues, the final disposition of the territories, Jerusalem, refugees, the core questions, then he said they will come. There's seems to be skepticism that the Bush administration might be more interested in a photo op, and therefore they are not committing themselves to attending, but saying if we know that the conference is there to launch final status talks, as they call it, you know, discuss these core questions, mm-hmm. you know, then they'll be at the table. So it is interesting, but I think part of the issue is that I'm not convinced yet the administration is fully defined whether it views this conference as a launch pad for final status, or rather it sees it as a more general offering of support for the new government of Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Salam Fayyad to help build Palestinian institutions, which is supposedly the core mandate of Tony Blair, who just arrived in the region.
As a Mideast envoy. Now, when you say final status, you're talking about what kind of Palestinian state with what kind of security guarantees for Israel, correct?
Right. Final status is often seen as the full range of the core questions, which is how do they carve up the lines of the territory? What's going to be the state of Jerusalem and the holy sites and the sovereignty of in the city? And what about the fate of the Palestinian refugees? That's generally viewed as known as final status in the kind of diplomatic jargon. That was the last really discussed on an official level during Bill Clinton's presidency at Camp David in July of 2000. And then the president came up with what he calls the Clinton parameters to kind of refine this focus on these core questions even further in December of 2000. But violence then broke out with an intifada that went on for 4 years, and we've not had those sorts of discussions for the last 7 years.
Right. Well, that conference, as close as it came, the Camp David conference, and then I guess later the Taba Conference, as it's known, at the very end of the Clinton administration. As close as they came, they still failed to get a bilateral agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Is there reason to think that it would be easier to get those two parties to yes, or harder, if other countries like Saudi Arabia and whatever these other moderate Arab states are, were also at the table with their agendas?
I think that's a very good point, because I think what was missing in the year 2000 were two factors. One, undeniably, that the Arab states kind of sat it out, that they did not urge the Palestinians to reach a deal, that they were kind of bystanders. And that was kind of a missing piece, if you will. And that's what this involvement of the Gulf states, who are kind of awash in oil revenue, that is supposed to correct that deficiency of the year 2000. I think the second point, which is, you know, will be debated for generations, but I personally believe you had Yasser Arafat defining success differently than others defined it for him. I think others defined it for him what he gets territorially and economically. I personally believe, having studied him and talked to dozens and dozens of people who know him and follow him, and I think that he defined success by what he didn't yield ideologically, that in the Arab history books they couldn't say that Yasser Arafat compromised on Palestinian rights. So, you know, those were different times. You also have a new factor, which frankly is spurring the moderates. Some say it's the noose around the neck that concentrates the mind, which is the ascendance of Hamas, the Islamist government, which is now in a rump government in Gaza. That is telling the moderates, both Palestinians and Israelis alike, you either come together and solve this conflict, or this is your future, the creeping Islamization of the West Bank.
David Makovsky, my guest on WNYC. He is a senior fellow and the director of the Peace Process Project for the Washington Institute the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And we can take phone calls for him on the Saudi announcement this morning that it would take part in its first ever talks with Israel as part of a regional meeting, and anything else going on relating to the Israeli Arab peace process. 212-433-WNYC. And Iran comes into this, Iraq comes into this. We'll get to all of that. 212-433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Let me go back to this idea of a regional peace conference with what the AP called moderate Arab states. Besides Saudi Arabia, what other countries might take part in such a conference?
Well, it would be wonderful if all the six Gulf states, that's Saudi, that's, Qatar, the Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, the United Arab Emirates. It would be a great show of support. I think Qatar has kind of emerged as kind of the biggest surprise in a negative sense. They are, according to Palestinians, say that they have given $400 million to Hamas, apart from Iran giving a lot of money to Hamas. So Qatar seems to be kind of playing a double game, but I think if they all showed up and offered their backing, it would be something very positive. I should say, in case there are kind of history buffs out there in your listening audience.
Oh, there are.
Good. Well, then I'll be happy to, you know, to discuss this with them, that, you know, if you want to be technical about it, Saudi Prince Bandar Ibn Sultan was an observer at the 1991 Madrid peace agreement, a peace conference that Secretary of State James Baker convened on October 30th, I believe it was.
I see. So technical, there was a Saudi representative at something else in the past that could be called talks with Israel.
Right. He was an observer. He wasn't, I assume here when they say participate, they mean really a full seat at the table. The Saudis also participated, for your history buffs, in a second concept of talks in the 90s, which is, you know, we haven't seen since the 1990s, since the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration, called the multilateral peace talks, which were to discuss regional questions like water issues and arms control and things like that. And the Saudis, I believe, did participate in those talks as well.
And don't you
those
know, David,
not,
Don't you know that when it comes to the Middle East, everybody's a history buff?
Well, it's great. It's good to, you know, every time I feel like I'm, you know, laboring alone, I find that there are viewers out there or listeners out there who follow this stuff and care. So that's actually a source of comfort to me.
Because people will call up from any side of this and say, but what about in 1948 when they, and what about in 1920 when they,
so yeah, that's fine.
I presume Iran, which is not an Arab country and which is very hard line right now with respect to Israel, would not take part. How much of the impetus for something like this comes from the growing Shiite-Sunni divide in the region, growing from the Iraq War? Saudis are mostly Sunnis. Iranians are mostly Shiites, for example. Is there an Arab desire to weaken Iran's, and for that matter, the Shiites' growing influence that plays into whatever impetus there is for a conference?
I think, Brian, you raise an important point. I've talked to three Arab foreign ministers recently alone, and they all mention Iran to me. They're very nervous about the ascendance of Iran. They don't say it publicly, or if they do in these Gulf, what they call the Gulf Cooperation Council, the meeting that sometimes they have with the United States of the Gulf states, they'll speak in very oblique terms. But they say, one of them said to me, David, you know, we got to move on this. You know, why is Ahmadinejad, who's the president of and the leading hardliner, who's called for wiping Israel off the face of the earth, why does Ahmadinejad get to play the Palestinian card? He said, that's our card, you know, as Arabs. And the United States, which has been leading this process, you know, let's take our card back from him. And a peace conference would help us in that regard. So I think that for Rice, she sees this issue as kind of the glue that keeps the Arab states together on Iran. Yes, it's no favor to America because, after all, they don't want to see Iran grow for their own interests. So it's not a charity case here. But it's clearly, and I think in Rice's view, something that will help cement this Arab coalition against Iran. It's very questionable what the Arabs are actually going to do besides buying American weaponry in resisting Iran. Some of them have said that there would be a nuclear arms race in the Middle East if Iran does go forward as a way of trying to deter Iran. But privately, they're all worried. But often it happens in the Middle East. What they tell you privately is far more forthcoming than what they're willing to say publicly to their own people.
The U.S., by the way, also announced a big arms sale to the Saudis over the weekend, as you know. And there are questions of quid pro quo here for Saudi actions with respect to Israel and Iraq. Secretary Rice was asked that question at this Jeddah news conference, and here's what she said.
I don't think of this as some sort of quid pro quo. America has interests in this region that are well served by the ability of our long-standing allies to protect themselves against potential threats.
So do you see some kind of grand bargain between the United States and Saudi Arabia that involves weapons, but that also involves moderating positions toward Iraq and Israel?
Iraq, I would put in a different thing, but Iran, I do think, as the secretary said, and, you know, there's a lot of diplomatic protocol whereby people never announce at a press conference with a foreign dignitary, oh, this is all linked. Privately, they will say, look, we have these sets of concerns, and I hope you understand them. So there is a genuine convergence of interest between the U.S. and the other Sunni leaders in the Gulf against Iran. But the United States is making clear, you know, you want to, you know, you're the guys telling us take the card away from Ahmadinejad of Iran. So you got to, you know, we want you to participate. I think there's another piece of this, which is not just attendance at a peace conference. It's also what do the Saudis do to support the government of Mahmoud Abbas on the ground. I think oil revenues are, what, $76 a barrel or something like that. Mm-hmm. They were 23 not too long ago. You know, the amount of money that Saudi Arabia can do to help the Palestinians in the West Bank, don't give a nickel to the Israelis, but just help the Palestinians and to show that there's a change in their daily lives and alleviate some of the misery, I think would be the biggest help possible to moderates. I believe, talking to some Palestinian friends of mine, there was a commitment of the Saudis for $250 million, dollars, but that was never materialized. The check was never in the mail, so to speak. So I think apart from backing American diplomatic efforts, by providing financial assistance, they could show that to the moderates that, you know, moderation pays. Because certainly the Iranians, whether it's $400 million or more to Hamas, and if it's the Qataris giving to Hamas, that, you know, the moderates see that the extremists are willing to back up their people. How come the moderates are not doing the same? I think here the Gulf could be crucial.
Hisham on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning, guys. Brian, there's so much I would like to dispute with your guests, but I'm just going to take one example. After all, your guests represent a right-wing institution. In 2002...
They say a centrist institution, but go ahead.
Okay. In 2002, the Arab League adopted a Saudi initiative to have a full diplomatic relations with Israel in return for going back to the 1967 borders. Israel refused since then until last week. And in my analysis, that this new initiative that is going on now is only because of trying to form a coalition against Iran in the anticipation or probability of a soon attack on Iran. That's my comment, and I'll listen up there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. David Makovsky.
All right. Thank the caller for his comments. Look, I don't want to get into characterizations, but I feel that, you know, anyone who follows, you know, my writings, Dennis Ross, who was the Middle East peace envoy for Bill Clinton.
You two work together, right?
George Bush. Yeah, we're a team at the Washington Institute. We're believers in a two-state solution, dignity for both sides. And we think if it only works for one side, it's not going to work. And we believe that any part of the deal means that there's got to be, you know, Israel's going to have to yield, you know, much or almost the entire West Bank, if not all of it, but only for secure and recognized borders. So I failed to see how being supportive of a two-state solution and dignity for both sides makes us a right-wing institution, but of course the caller is free to make his own conclusions.
And on his point regarding the
Saudi initiative.
Right.
Look, I think Israel made a mistake in 2002, you know, by being dismissive of that. It was at the height of an intifada where there was like 25 bombs, I think, went off in March, including one at a hotel during Passover where many Israelis were killed. And the initiative was announced in a way that didn't show any sympathy for that. I think the situation meant that that people didn't look at the words of the initiative closely enough. And I think you heard from Israeli Prime Minister Olmert, where he is consistently, and Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni of Israel, both of them have talked about the many positive elements of the Arab initiative. They have welcomed now the Egyptian and the Jordanian foreign ministers to Israel last week and welcome more such dialogue. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that Israel in its looking at the Saudi initiative, you know, has not even complained about its territorial dimension, about the 67 borders, you know, has had one kind of concern. But, you know, I think I've met with these Arab foreign ministers, some of them who are key on this initiative quietly, and they say, David, it's not a take it or leave it proposition. You know, we want some give and take. We're not going to substitute for direct Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. We're there to supplement it and to provide an umbrella. And I think that's exactly right. And I think I'm very happy that the Saudis have, you know, have put forward their ideas as a starting point for talks. And I think that any ultimate deal is going to come very close to, you know, what they have put
forward. So this is very interesting to me, because you seem to be saying that Israel is ready now to give up more of the West Bank than it was at the end of the Clinton administration.
I do. I mean, I personally believe, my own personal view is that, you know, the Bill Clinton plan got you to 97% of the West Bank. The key in creativity, it seems to me, is to find what is called territorial land swaps, which the Palestinians have accepted as a principle. By the way, even Yasser Arafat accepted it. That would say, look, we'd like to get from 97 to 100%. We know Israel has certain settlement blocks near what's called the old 1967 Green Line, as it is referred to. Well, maybe Israel will keep some of those, but we'll find land swaps within the 67 lines that could offset that. And I think that's where you could get to 100%. So I think that the land swaps and that creativity, which is acceptable to the Palestinians, is the key to solving it. But if it was only about land, then I think, you know, Jimmy Carter would have a point. But I would argue it's not just about land. And frankly, Israel was willing to solve the land issue in 2000. The problem of the refugees, I think, is the core. And, you know, the issue of finessing Jerusalem. I think they're basically, you know, Jerusalem's going to have to be divided. And but there should be no sovereignty over any of these religious sites, because if you have politicians deciding sovereignty over contested religious sites, you're going to have a religious war there by one of the sides that's on the losing end. So who needs that? But I think you could solve that one. I think on the refugees, it seems clear to me, as Sari Nusseibeh, a leading Palestinian intellectual, has said, that the hope is that, you know, we want to build this new state so the refugees go to the new state of Palestine. And that's why we're building this two-state solution. But if they think they could also go to the state of Israel, it will destroy Israel as a Jewish state, and Israel would be suicidal to accept it.
We'll continue in a minute with David Makovsky, director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process, where he partners with former Clinton negotiator Dennis Ross for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, also former executive editor of the Jerusalem Post and chief diplomatic correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. More with David Makovsky. Your calls at 212-433-WNYC. In a minute, including Secretary Rice now off to Israel after Saudi Arabia. Can she get Israel to the table at this regional conference? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and you have just an hour and a half left to join us in our group journalism project. Your part is really easy. Just go outside and count the number of total cars on your block and the number of SUVs among those cars. We want to know just how prevalent are these vehicles in an urban area like New York. The New York Times revealed this morning, did you see it, that two SUVs can often be seen idling outside Mayor Bloomberg's home, even to take him to his subway stop. You ever drive an SUV to the subway? What's the count on your block? Again, just count the number of total cars parked on your block and the number of SUVs among those cars, then post the results on our website, WNYC.org. You can post right on the homepage. You'll see where. But the deadline is 1 o'clock this afternoon, so we can crunch the numbers for tomorrow's show. 1 o'clock deadline. We've already got more than 300 people taking part. Go outside for a few minutes and join them. We'll talk about the numbers and what they mean on tomorrow's show. Well, we're talking about some developments in the Middle East peace process, or developments that could rekindle a Middle East process, and what they mean, with David Makovsky, director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We talked about Condi Rice and Robert Gates in Saudi Arabia this morning. And now Secretary of State Rice is off to Israel, David, to try and get Palestinians and Israelis closer to renewing talks, really for the first time since the Clinton administration. Do you think the time may be right for that for them?
I think it's crucial that a big push be made now, because I think we missed an opportunity in 2005. Yasser Arafat had passed on, and Abu Mazen and Mahmoud Abbas had won with a 62% majority calling for a two-state solution. Ariel Sharon at the time was active and was going to lead the pullout of, turning on the settlers and getting out of the Gaza Strip. I think that was a moment in 2005 that the Bush administration missed to make this not unilateral, but part of a broader peace process where Mahmoud Abbas could gain the credit. I think we missed that opening. Hamas then came to power. And now, in the summer of 2007, by Hamas overreaching and engaging in a coup d'etat in Gaza. And by the way, if you look at the most recent poll of Al-Najah, which is a Palestinian university that just came out, a reputable, they call it that, almost by, almost 60% margin, and said that Gaza, Hamas will not be able to govern Gaza. You've got a tremendous prime minister now on the Palestinian side, Salam Fayyad, who was someone who has proven himself as finance minister, is cutting corruption. He's got a PhD from the University of Texas.
But let me read you another point of view from a post from the liberal Jewish blog Rootless Cosmopolitan by Tony Karen. It says, Mark Perry of Conflict Forum offers 10 very compelling reasons why Hamas will prevail over Fatah in the current political struggle, including... The Islamists today represent the Palestinian mainstream, while Fatah is broken from top to bottom. Even more importantly, it says, Abbas is increasingly isolated within Fatah, most of whose grassroots and mid-level leadership want nothing to do with the U.S. schemes on which Abbas has staked his future. By Halloween, it says, expect Abbas to be either back in a unity government with Hamas, a role that would put him on the wrong side of the United States, or else having departed the scene entirely. What do you think about that, especially the analysis that the Islamists today represent the Palestinian mainstream?
Well, I respectfully disagree. Even, by the way, in 2006 when Hamas won, I believe they only won about 45% of the vote. But because of the way the districts were done, they did well. All the polls showed that part of the support of Hamas was due to people worried about corruption, Fatah mismanaging the campaign. But I was just in Ramallah. I met with many Palestinians. And in my view, if this conflict is transformed from a nationalist conflict, which is going to be hard enough to solve, to a religious conflict, once it becomes a religious fundamentalist conflict, it becomes impossible to compromise.
You don't think the Palestinian territories are trending that way, as is so much of the rest of the Middle East?
Look, you see their influence in Gaza. Right now in the West Bank, it's been, they have not been that strong. But there could be this creeping Islamization if moderate people do nothing. That means if the United States does nothing, if the Europeans do nothing, the Saudis do nothing, if the Israelis do nothing. I think Olmert, understands this. He began releasing 250 prisoners, releasing a few hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think you've got a guy in the case of Fayyad who's got, impeccable Palestinian nationalist credentials, but as someone who believes he wants to build an accountable society based on pluralism and democracy. And I feel the Bush administration, missed the opportunity of 2005. And now history rarely gives second chances. Now's that second chance to become more activistic and energetic and not let this be transformed into a religious conflict. And once it does, it's over. Then compromise is impossible.
Let's take another phone call. Ali in Ridgewood. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Ali.
Hi, good morning. Two-part question. First question is, why does this gentleman cast a conflict in terms of the impact of perceived illegitimate Palestinian aspirations and machinations and that impact on legitimate Israeli entities on, making peace? Second question is, what impact do you think European positivist discourse has in terms of the way Israelis perceive their Palestinian neighbors, i.e. the assertion that these people are not rational and they don't have the same enlightenment values as we do, therefore we can't negotiate with them on equal terms? Thank you.
Thank you.
Look, I think the following, that if you have a situation where you have half of the Palestinian people who have stuck their neck out for a two-state solution and have been willing to pay the price for that support, for us suddenly to pull the rug out from our allies on the Palestinian side, the moderates, and say, you know what, we're now going to deal with Hamas, and you could be for the destruction of Israel and be a legitimate interlocutor, then I think we pull the rug out from under the moderates.
But how meaningful would any Palestinian-Israeli peace agreement be if Hamas is not a part of it, since they're the ones most responsible for continuing to attack Israel?
Look, Hamas is there to stay. I have no doubt. But I think because of issues of U.S. inaction, Fatah's corruption, mismanaged campaigns, the vagaries of electoral system, Hamas's victory was magnified when the support shows that they never had more than 40-45%. I think if the moderates showed results on the ground whereby the economy started getting better, peace talks were launched, and that Israel was engaged in these substantive issues, that have languished for a while, you know, the moderates would have something to show, then I think Hamas would shrink from the 40, 45 to its natural size, which has been in the 20s. And some say 15%. So are they there to stay? No one's going to say that there's no, could be no Hamas tomorrow. But the fact is there's been a silent majority that has been silent for too long. And unless the moderates on the Israeli and Palestinian side come together without American, European, and broader Arab support, then don't be surprised that there's going to be increased radicalization. That's the surest recipe for radicalization to grow.
Fred in Muncie, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. David, I want to ask you, you just talked about radicalism. How much pressure are the European and the American delegates secretaries putting on the Saudis to start reining in these madrasas? The latest figure is $275 million that the Saudis have been spreading around the world to all of these madrasas, which are really inflaming and are fundamentalist in title.
Fred, thank you. David, do you accept his premise? And then if so, do you think that's one of the things that Secretary Rice may have talked with the Saudis about?
Look, I assume a staple of the bilateral U.S.-Saudi relationship is concern about the madrasas around the world. I focus my own specialties on the Arab-Israeli side of this, and I think the Saudis were alarmed that the Iranians are paying money to Hamas because they see Iran as a non-Arab, a Shia, a foreign element that should not be kind of getting into the sphere of influence of Arabs. So that's why the Saudis seem to have been alarmed about that. The people, unfortunately, that I think have been the most negative right now in supporting Hamas, per se, has been Iran and, unfortunately, Qatar.
Also on the Saudis, there is the Saudi participation in Iraq, which we mentioned before. There's widespread belief that the Saudis are actually aiding some of the Sunni fighters in the civil war there. This came up at the news conference this morning, and we're going to play a clip of Saud al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister, who says he was astounded over the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Salmeh Khalilzad, commenting that the Saudis are undermining the Iraqi government.
But I was astounded by what he said, especially since we had never heard from him these criticism when he was here.
So, David Makovsky, I realize your particular specialty is the Israeli-Palestinian process, but do you have any thought on Saudi participation in the Iraq war and how that might even play into the idea of this larger regional conference that we're talking about with respect to Israel?
Well, I think the administration in Washington was clearly disappointed when King Abdullah at the Arab League summit called what was going on in Iraq an illegal foreign occupation. The U.S. had hoped, and particularly that Bandar ibn Sultan, who was the Saudi ambassador here and now is the national security advisor in Riyadh, that he would kind of help broker some deal of greater Saudi support for the U.S. I think the Saudis, for their part, believe the U.S. doesn't exactly know what it's doing in Iraq, so it feels that it's charting its own course. And to be fair, they've always been wary of a Shia-led Iraq. So I don't know if they've exactly been on the program, so to speak, as far as this administration is concerned. But I would hope that at least there's a convergence of interests when it comes to the Arab-Israeli issue, that they will be supportive. And I repeat that it's not just about attending a peace conference and hopefully, you know, showing Israel that it wants to integrate Israel into the Middle East as part of an overall package, but that it's about economic assistance to Palestinians on the ground, also given by Israel, too, to the Palestinians and the U.S. and the Europeans, but so people in the West Bank can see a real tangible change in their lives. I believe a solution that doesn't give dignity to both sides of this conflict is doomed to fail, but we have to do what we can.
We have 1 minute left, and you talked about the moderates on both sides needing to seize the moment. What about the moderates in Israel? How much pressure do you think they're going to come from, that will come from the Israeli right to stop any of this momentum we've been talking about?
Well, that's a big question. We don't know for sure. I felt on my most recent trip there, just I went to Ramallah. I also met Israelis in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. I seem to think that many on the right see that it's inevitable that there's a two-state solution. They just want to know that Israel is more secure rather than more vulnerable. When they see rocket fire of Qassam rockets coming from Gaza, even though Israel left Gaza, or they see Katushas coming from Lebanon that they saw in last year's war, they say war, it means not land for peace, but land for violence.
The right has worked against a two-state solution for a long time, and they've been successful.
Right. They've been successful, and that's why it's the Olmert government, where all the deficiencies of Olmert as a leader, according to the polls, he doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. He now has a new defense minister, Ehud Barak, and the Labor Party. And I think they both believe that unless they somehow address this issue, that's the future. There's going to be more stridency on all sides. And I'm not equating the different types of stridency. But I think the moderates have to, they've all should look into the abyss that we've seen over the last year and a half with the ascendance of Hamas and say, if moderates do not come together, there's a very bleak future for Israelis and Palestinians.
David Makovsky, director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He works very closely on that with Dennis Ross, the former Clinton lead negotiator during the 1999 and 2000 part of the peace process. David has also been executive editor of the Jerusalem Post. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Brian, thank you very much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. A new musical about losing things and finding some of them in New York. We'll hear some songs and talk to some participants. Stay with us.